The one person that I've used on everything besides myself is Bob Kulick, who's been a friend of mine for about 6 years. Actually, he tried out for Kiss, and he's a great guitar player, and I used him on everything. Bob and I have been working together for about 5 or 6 years. I've been fooling around playing with Bob since I've known him, and he and I play very, very well together, so he knows exactly the way I think, so that was easy.
What are we waiting for?
All right. Greetings from Jindal. It's your boy, Jody Havnot. I'm here with my boy,
Andrew.
That's Mr. Kiss to you.
Mr. Kiss.
Hi, Curly.
So anyway, what do we got going on today, Andrew?
Well, we got something a little special.
Yes, we do. I was able to interview Bob Kulick, you know. Everybody in the Kiss world knows exactly who that dude is.
Yes.
A really cool guy, and it was really nice of him to give us a little bit of time to talk about Kiss. And before we get into that, I was thinking, why don't we do a quick little top three or something of what are your favorite things that Bob's done with Kiss, Andrew?
Ooh, top three.
You got the whole fucking Paul Stanley album. You got
Killers.
Killers. You got the Songs of Alive 2. You also got Naked City.
Oh.
So what are you thinking?
Well, I don't know. Like, all those solos are bitching on Paul's album, so I'm definitely going to have to go with that. And we were talking earlier, and, like, that's the guitar tone you sort of strive for when you were younger, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Not only the tone, but just I loved the way he played, you know?
Or the style, too, yeah. I love it when he emulates Ace, but I like it even a hell of a lot more when he does his own thing, too.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish some of that stuff... Like, didn't he work a bit on the Creature sessions, too?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish some of that stuff would have ended up on there, though. That would have been some cool stuff, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Dude, he's as scorch as everything he does on Killers, man. Like, especially Nowhere to Run. Have you heard that solo lately?
Yeah, there's got to be some sort of awesome genetics in the Kulick family.
Oh, yeah. The Kulick brothers, both of them rip, dude. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no doubt about that. But, yeah, one thing Bob always does that I always like is... He'll bend, you know, almost like two full steps.
Yeah.
It's dope, you know. It's really cool. And I actually do that because of Bob. Mm-hmm. I strive to anyways, you know. But yeah, I've always been a big fan of what he did in Kiss.
It's kind of funny how, like, when you first didn't know that he was on the Live 2.
Right.
Or just even on Killers, like, back in the day. And just, like, people... Like, oh, that's a great Ace solo, whatnot. They're just they're influenced by that and not realizing that that was really Bob.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. For years, people, you know, people didn't know. It wasn't, like, common knowledge like it is today, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was like me just with, I thought that was a bitchin' Vinny solo on Exciter. Apparently not.
Right. Yeah, it's crazy, you know? But Bob, he has a distinct style. Like, even when he was trying to play like Ace... You can tell it's not Ace once you get a little bit older and you play guitar, especially. It's
well, like, no matter how much you're going to emulate an artist, you can never really sound exactly like them. And I know that's a Tommy Thayer joke, so enjoy right. that, folks.
There's a funny story about how, like, when Bob had got done cutting, you know, like Larger Than Life and stuff, he came out and Ace was there that day. He was just like,
How'd I sound?
Yeah, and he's like, better than you ever have, or something like that. You know, just joking with each other. It's great. Yeah. It's really cool. I actually should have probably asked him about that in the interview, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, how that goes. You forget things.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have liked to hear it from him.
Yes.
But anyways, so if you had to pick, what would your top three Bob Kulick Kiss solos be, man?
Probably definitely Larger Than Life.
Oh, yeah. There's a different mix that you can get. Like, it's on YouTube. And it's, like, Larger Than Life, like a different take. And it's just a smoking. But I think I like the one that, you know, that we're used to. Probably a little bit better. Yeah, I would go with Larger Than Life for sure. And I'd also go with I love what he does on Nowhere to Run, man. He's fucking smoking on that one. You like that one?
Yeah. Well, I like all his work on the Killers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But you know which one I really like is I love Wouldn't You Like to Know Me. That's power pop mastery, dude.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, I think that was my top Paul song, too.
Right. I think it was. For the third one, man, I think I would probably have to pick... I don't know. You give me your third.
I really wish I prepared for this more.
You know which one I'm going to go with? I'm going to go with Ain't Quite Right. He's really tasteful in that one, you know? It's almost kind of... To me, it almost has like a... Almost like a Latin feel in a way. Kind of a Santana-ish kind of feel. And I like that Bob can do... He doesn't just do one thing, you know what I mean? He's pretty versatile. He's an all-around musician.
Did he do the solo on Hold Me, Touch Me?
He did not.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, because as much as I hate that song, I love that solo.
Yeah, I do too. I believe that's Paul. I actually asked him about that in the interview. And speaking of the interview, without any further ado, we're going to go ahead and roll the Bob Kulick interview I did earlier tonight, and we'll see you on the other side of that. All right, Strange Ways people out there. I'm super excited today to be talking to Mr. Bob Kulick, a Grammy Award-winning producer, guitar player, composer, arranger, and an all-around awesome dude. How you doing, Bob?
Good. Thanks for having me today. How's it going there?
Man, I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be talking to you, man. I'm a big fan. I was curious, though, man. How'd your game go? Did you guys win?
We had a softball game today with a bunch of, you know, rock and roll guys that come out and play on Sunday here in Las Vegas. So we had a good time, and nobody got hurt.
Right on. That's a good day in my book.
Yeah, me
too. I'm a huge Kiss fan. This is a Kiss podcast, so we're mostly going to center on the Kiss aspect of your career. But I wanted to kind of know about your early days. I mean, what made you pick up a guitar in the first place?
Well, I was always a fan and had gone to the Murray DeKay shows, which were the disc jockey Murray DeKay put on these shows in Brooklyn, New York. So they had like Christmas shows and Easter shows and Labor Day shows. And he'd get the top talent of the early 60s to play one song or two songs each at this mammoth show that he would have. So he'd have 15, 20 artists. Right. And, you know, we'd all go early and, you know, get a good seat in the first three or four rows and be able to watch, you know, the talent of that generation get up there and dish it out. So I was always into that. But my first introduction to guitar came from my cousin, who was playing folk music, and at a family event was playing guitar. And my mother kind of said, "Why can't you do something like that?" So I kind of took up the challenge and asked her to show me a few chords and moved on from there. Once I actually felt like, wow, this is something I can do, then it became a whole other thing once I realized that this is where my gift was and that this is what I should be pursuing rather than all of the other stuff I thought I was interested in.
That's what's up. And the rest is history, as they say. And so who were your early influences as far as guitar players, like Clapton, Hendrix?
Well, before that, obviously, you know, seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan was, you know, an epiphany for millions of people.
Right.
To actually see guys get up there who had a unique vibe, who could play their own instruments, who could write their own songs, who could sing, and had the magic. So this was the, you know, the bell tolling that something was changing in the music business, and my infatuation with them spurred me on to want to be like the Beatles, play in a band.
Right.
Do that. So, you know, certainly George Harrison, you know, the original guys that I was lucky enough to see, George Harrison and Keith Richards when I saw the Rolling Stones the first time they came to New York. And bands like that were the first ones that really kind of influenced me. And then, of course, later on, as, you know, the, shall we say, the instrumental vibe of what it was started to take over. Jimi Hendrix, who I was lucky enough to know from the Greenwich Village days when he played as Jimmy James in the Blue Flames.
Right.
At the Cathedral, the club that my baby band played at.
Right. There's a famous story where you gave him a guitar string, right?
Yes. We were hanging around backstage. You know, we played during the day to the kids, and, you know, Richie Havens and Richard Pryor and Jimmy James, Jimi Hendrix played at night in a place that mainly was, you know, malts and sandwiches and soda pop. Didn't have an alcohol license, but it was, you know, one of the main places on Bleecker Street, And in the 60s, you know, between the Cafe One, the Night Owl, and the Seeing John, and the Cafe Agogo, these are the places that attracted thousands and thousands of kids to Greenwich Village. So he busted a string in the dressing room, and, you know, he was kind of like, I don't have any more strings. I kind of just took a package of strings out of, you know, my guitar case and just said, help yourself.
Right on.
So he asked me what my name was. I told him Bob, and, you know, from that moment, you know, we knew each other. So I know this is mentioned in Wikipedia, and is a true story.
Yeah.
So, you know, he played at the club for 6 weeks and then was taken to England, came back Jimi Hendrix, and the rest is history, as you say.
That's great, man. I had heard a podcast you did, I think it was on Podkist, and you were telling them how you got to, you know, just hang out, and you were hanging out in a hotel with Hendrix, you know, passing around joints and shit. That's just cool, I think.
Yeah, there was, you know, he came back and he was on the Monkees tour the night he got fired after playing Central Park. He had a bunch of the guys from the Village Days over, and we all hung out. And I remember he brought like a portable 45, you know, record player and some speakers, and had a stack of 45s that he brought back from England.
Oh, cool!
And was playing them for the, you know, the five or six guys that he had invited, of which I was one, up to the hotel, and you know, got to hang. And you know, it was a great feeling to be around somebody who, you know, we all knew was a genius and was way ahead of his time, and somebody who could play better with his teeth than most people could with their hands.
That's true. You know, we've all of us Kiss freaks kind of know the story of your audition with Kiss, but I want to hear it from you. Can you give us just kind of a, how was it for you? I mean, you saw the ad in the papers, right?
Yeah, I the Village Voice, and not unlike, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 other gigs that I had auditioned for from the Village Voice, you know, rock band looking for a lead guitar player, Led Zeppelin style band.
Right.
So I went down and met Paul and Gene, and we jammed on a few tunes, you know, just jammed, and then played a couple of things that they had concocted, and then they kind of showed me a prototype photo of the makeup, and we talked for a few minutes, and that was really about it, other than what I didn't realize was that Ace had come into the room and sat down, and, you know, because I guess there was nobody to tell him to wait outside the room, he just came in and sat down. It was of no importance to me.
Right.
But Paul called me a couple of weeks later, you know, the guy that showed up after you, he kind of fit in with what we were doing better than, you know, we felt, you know, conceptually for what you were doing, although you're, you know, a better player. You know, so, you know, I took him at face value and just kept in touch with them. And we're playing Coventry, come see us play. Sure. You know, so I became their friend. And then when they made it, I was still their friend. And then the rest just bloomed on from there. When Ace couldn't play, I was asked to come down and help out and pull a solo record and writing songs with Gene and demos of other songs and all of what it turned into.
When you were at that audition, could you tell that they were going to become what they became, you know, like a band 40 years strong, you know, in the fabric of like Americana, you know? Did you realize it at that time, or was it just another band?
No, if I did, I would have sucked up to them and got the gig.
That's what's up. You know, but they were playing, like, a lot of the stuff off the first album at that time, right? Like Deuce and stuff?
Not really. We didn't go through any real songs.
Really?
There was nothing that I could recognize that, you know, again, they were a band called Wicked Lester. They weren't even Kiss.
Right. So what did you think when you went to that first Coventry show, when you saw them in all the makeup and everything? Did it kind of click for you, or what?
You know, I realized that, you know, that the gimmick was the foremost thing that they had going for them, because, you know, certainly they weren't Led Zeppelin, and they weren't Cream, and they were, you know, not in the caliber of those players at that moment.
Right.
So, basically, it was the, you know, the gimmick, the costume, the whole thing, and the makeup, you know, and I realized that, you know, like some of the other bands at the time, you know, they thought it was, oh, he painted his face and did all this stuff, so I realized this was a more, you know, show-busy attempt rather than just a muso, you know, Cream. The three guys got up there and they just played whatever came to mind. There were 20-minute jams, and this was not that. This was a very song-oriented with gimmick vibe.
Very,
you know,
defined.
So I liked what I saw. You know, they were getting better as a band. It was more defined, obviously. And, you know, we, you know, Gene London and Paul and I became friends. You know, they respected me as a guitar player, and they saw that I was out there getting real gigs. So, you know, the vibe was there, you know, and the respect was there. They acknowledged I was a great guitar player, and I acknowledged that they were on their way.
That's what's up. Was there ever a moment when you were like, damn, I wish I would have got that gig? You know what I'm saying?
You know, there was really, you know, I'm not the kind of person that looks back on stuff like that. You know, obviously, it would have been great. Would have been a different band, obviously. And that's why kind of when people hear me on Kiss Killer, the Kiss Alive 2, or on Paul's record or whatever, you know, they're hearing a different guitar player who would have brought something different to the table.
Right. But still completely cohesive, man.
Yes.
I love the way you play on those records. And when I was a kid, I didn't even know the difference. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're all there trying to sound like Ace Smith. To the connoisseur who knows, Ace never did some of the things that I played, so
right. Yeah.
They let certain things go by that I was just like, oh, okay. You know, but it was also my chance to show them, here's what you would have sounded like with me on guitar.
Right.
And the fact that it was, you know, Larger Than Life and All American Man and No Way to Run, those solos speak for themselves, you know. Not Ace Frehley.
Yeah. One thing you do that he never had really done was, like, I like when you bend, like, it's almost like, two full steps, you know what I'm saying?
And the overbend stuff was something that he would never do.
Yeah,
so
that's totally Bob Kulick.
It sounded so good.
Yeah, I think it's awesome.
But well, we were certainly in the same ballpark, you know, Jimmy Page kind of,
yeah.
You know, trick figures and the bend notes and all of that. Right. I mean, Paul and Gene were fans of all the guitar players. I was fans of George Harrison and Keith Richards and Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix. You know, these were the people who we grew up on, and so, you know, they loved those players, and hence my style, which was somewhere in there, you know, and Dick, who was another guy who played with Lou Reed and played with Alice Cooper, who I was lucky enough to work with, who actually played on a couple of Kiss records as well when Ezra was producing. He was another guy who was a big influence that they also really liked. So, you know, we liked the same kind of music, you know, but they had made their bed with Ace, and, you know, honestly, he was a great character. You know, all anybody has to do is watch the Tom Snyder Show.
Right.
You know, they just go on YouTube and you hear how here's a guy who didn't necessarily, you know, spout the party line like Gene and Paul, who, you know, was a character in and of him by himself and made some really funny jokes and sort of helped them in a way that they, Gene and Paul were almost too serious while Ace was sort of like, you know, the comedic relief.
Right. So I want to move into Paul's solo album.
All right!
And we were talking just a little bit before we got rolling here, but I was telling you that, like, I'm a huge Paul Stanley solo album fanatic. It was one of my big records as a kid. And it turns out that, you know, I'm a guitar player too, and I'm influenced by Bob, by his style on that record, just as much as I am by Ace Frehley. And I just think it's really cool to be talking to the guy. And what I wanted to know that a lot of people probably haven't asked you about that record is, what gear were you using at the time? Sounds like old Marshalls. Were you using a Mockingbird, or what were you playing on?
I did use some BC Rich stuff. I played Paul's TV model, Les Paul Jr.
Nice.
I had my old Les Paul at the time that I was playing. I didn't pay that much attention. They were old Marshalls. There were a bunch of Marshalls there. You know, I was more interested in the playing than I was documenting, so I just, you know, never thought of it that way. We were just having fun, you know, in a great circumstance where, you know, Paul and they were all doing solo records, and it was like, you know, you got, you know, Richie Fontana, who played drums, you know, one of the Coin bands, Piper, they became friendly, so he asked him to play, and then he asked me, you know, do you have a suggestion for bass players? And I suggested the guy that I was playing with Meatloaf, Steve Buslow, who was a great bass player. And so the four of us, you know, would be out there in the room, and Electric Lady, we just would work up whatever song it was and play it down organically until it was a good take. And there was really no producer. Paul knew what he wanted. You know, it wasn't rocket science. They were just good songs. And then, you know, by the time we started to do it in earnest, you know, we'd gone to L.A., and you know, four or five of the songs were done, then we did another four or five songs there, and just, you know, just kept going until there was enough that there was a record, you know, we used some different people on some different songs. Carmine Appice played on a song, and, you know, there were a few other people involved, but it was mainly that core group of people that played.
Right.
And, you know, it was just a great vibe with no pressure. We just had a lot of fun. And, like I said, I didn't really document very much of it other than, you know, I knew what he wanted, and he knew that, you know, I could deliver what it was that he wanted. So, you know, with that kind of confidence and camaraderie, it was not like a tooth extraction. It was just having fun. And, you know, even, you know, some of the sessions in L.A. that went on for a while when we did Goodbye, I remember, you know, working on some of the parts for a few hours rather than just a solo.
Right.
You know, he'd more than just a solo, you know, the ascending line. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. You know, he had some ideas which he would sing to me. I'd be like, that's a great idea. I'll just play that. I never had an ego about that. If somebody had something they wanted me to play, I would always try to incorporate it, whether it was Blackie Lawless or Paul Stanley or Gene or whoever it was, whatever it was. I was always able to be the guy who was just like, well, sure, you know, if you have a specific thing you're looking for, yeah, play high notes here. Sure, whatever you like. You know, you know, my vocabulary was such that, you know, it was just like, sometimes, you know, either let me play or, you know, give me the, you know, the ballpark of what you want, and I'll just keep it inside there.
There you go. I think you fit really well with Paul's style, man. And like you said, you guys have the same influences and you were friends, so I could see making good music together. But
exactly. It was very natural.
Let me ask you this, and this is just a random question. I've always... Like, Hold Me, Touch Me, is that you on the lead on that, or is that Paul?
On Hold Me, Touch Me, I didn't play on that one.
Okay. Yeah, because I always thought, man, that doesn't really sound like Bob.
Yeah, I don't recall the credit specifically, but, you know, the big deal about that whole thing was that Gene wanted me to play on his record as well. There was a big argument about that. Paul's, you know, perspective, which was, you know, if we use the same people on all the records, then where's the solo record?
Right.
You know, so I had to, you know, respectfully get out of the way of that, and Gene wrote me a nice letter saying, you know, all right, well, next time, you know, I understand Paul's being, you know, a little territorial, but he also has a point, which is true. You know, I couldn't say that it wasn't true.
I'm one of these guys that I put Paul's at the top of the list as far as the solo records. A lot of people think Ace was the best one, but I think it's Paul's, man.
Well, you know, it's music. It's a matter of personal opinion and taste. Actually, Ace's record was the one that did best because he had Back in the New York Groove on there.
Yeah.
Song that he didn't write, but that, you know, was maybe the most commercial on those records.
Yeah, I mean, it sold the most, but to me, that song is highly overrated. I feel like something like, you know, Wouldn't You Like to Know Me should have been a number one hit, and radio was slipping, man. I don't know what was going on.
Yeah, it's music. It's a matter of personal opinion and taste.
Right.
Just saying, you know, the success of any of the individual records was not what they were trying to do. They were just trying to stretch their feet a little bit and show that they could step out of their role of, you know. Because, you know, Kiss is a very, very structured band. Even when I played with Paul on his 89 tour, all the arrangements were to the bar. There was never, we'll just keep going and we'll cue for the ending. There was never a piece like that.
Right.
You could start the stopwatch, and if the show would go as long as it would go, within 1 or 2 minutes, depending on, you know...
stage wraps.
You know, yeah, different introduction, or, you know, setup situation. But, you know, the timings of the songs were almost identical because there was no improvisation. It was all... They play a solo at the end, and that's it. Can we extend the solo at the end? No. Can we try tonight to extend the song? No. Can I give a cue to play out at the end of this? No. It was very structured. So I can understand them all wanting to get away from each other to try to just do their own thing, because by that time, they'd reached that point where, you know, they needed to get it out of their systems.
Right. The theory was that it was going to be a healthy thing for the band, but I think it was kind of like, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back in reality.
You know, they realized that being on the top was the ticket, carte blanche, to do whatever they want. So it's flop. Who cares?
Right.
What relevance is that? Where, you know, the band's not failing. You know, so that was the big ticket item.
Right.
Was that, you know, they were able to keep the train on the tracks, and even when there were, shall we say, lulls in the action, they were always able to, you know, it was Vinnie Vincent, then it was my brother, then it was Revenge, whatever it took, you know. So they were always able to pick themselves up when they fell down. If the Elder didn't do great, or, you know, they needed to change from the non-makeup band back to the makeup band, whatever it was, they were able to make it work. And to this very day, they were able to make it work, you know. So what does one say? The true sign of greatness is longevity.
Right.
So the fact that they're still out there doing it, all one can do is tip one's cap to them.
I think you're absolutely correct. So what was it like for you to know that, you know, you kind of ghosted for Ace on Alive 2, and at the time, nobody knew, and I think a lot of fans were like, wow, Ace is really shredding on this one, you know? Was it weird for you to not be able to tell anybody?
It didn't matter to me at all. I had a bandwidth record deal on Sony. I was doing session work for the top artists in the world, including Gene's introduction to me of Diana Ross,
right,
who I played on Why Do Fools Fall in Love and Mirror Mirror. And if you go on YouTube, Johnny Carson, Diana Ross, Mirror Mirror, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, there I am.
Yep.
So they helped me. Gene could have called Jeff Beck or anybody else, but he didn't. He called me, and that told me how he felt about me.
Hell yeah, that's awesome.
I agreed to do this. They knew that, but wow, Larger Than Life, Ace really played great. They knew it wasn't Ace.
Right.
That's all that mattered to me, was yeah. that they knew. Subsequent to that, sure, it was nice to, you know, I'm walking through casino, Hard Rock Hotel here, and some kid comes up to me. I learned to play guitar because I heard you play on Kiss Alive 2 and thought it was Ace, but it was actually you, and so I wanted to say thank you. So after all these years to be able to have that, when it happened, it meant a lot to me. It was like, well, what do you think? You just say, wow, I had no idea that, you know, we're all living inside our bubbles to a certain extent, you know, and, you know, I'm not somebody with a huge ego, so, you know, the understanding in my own mind that I've come to terms with it, whether people knew or not, was irrelevant to me.
Right.
You know, I have gold records. You know, I have a Grammy Award. I did the theme for Triple H. I did a song for SpongeBob. I don't need to be propped up by somebody saying, oh, he's the guy that played the solo flute. It's really lower on the scale than that, even though to a lot of people it's a big ticket item. So, you know, it's all a matter of perspective.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. And speaking of all your other projects, you got a brand new Randy Rhoads tribute CD that just came out, right?
Yes.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
It was a great project. Randy was the next generation of guitar players' idol, as opposed to the guys that I referenced earlier, Hendrix and Clapton and Beck and Page and George Harrison and them.
Right.
Eddie Van Halen and Randy Rhoads were the next generation's guitar gods. So, you know, I spoke to Tom Morello on the phone. So I understand you're a big Randy Rhoads fan. Well, I wouldn't put it quite that way. Oh, I named my child after Randy Rhoads. I practiced in front of his poster for 8 hours a day is how I learned how to play guitar. So he's my god.
Wow.
Oh, I see. So with Rudy Sarzo and Frankie Benali, guys who played with Randy Rhoads, guys from Ozzy's band who came on after, you know, Randy, you know, was killed in that horrific accident. Bernie Torme and Brad Gillis and Gus G, those guys,
yeah,
they're on the record. And people who were influenced by him, you have Joel Hoekstra, current guitar player in Whitesnake, Doug Aldrich, ex-guitar player from Whitesnake, Weasel Zappa, who, you know, was influenced by Rhoads, George Lynch, who was friends with Randy and taught at the same school. So I used the people who knew Randy to tell a story about Randy, both their playing and in the DVD interviews that I conducted at the Musonia School of Music, Randy's old school. So with the family's permission, I was able to do a record that, to me, had a lot of heart to it, adding Serge Tankian and Ripper Owens and Chuck Billy, you know, having some different singers that could really kick ass, I think really helped the overall thing to get it away from, you know, the Ozzy thing or the Kevin Dubrow thing for the Quiet Riot songs.
Right.
So, you know, I had a great time doing this and learning a lot about somebody that I never met or ever saw live, but had always admired. And so, you know, for John Donias and Alexi Laiho, the new guys, this was a way to say thank you to somebody who they probably wouldn't even be playing guitar if it wasn't for Randy Rhoads. Like Tom Morello said, you know, I named my kid after him, Rhoads Morello. What more can somebody say?
Right.
So the record's getting a great response, and as it should, it's a great record for a guy who deserves to be honored in the right way.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing to pay tribute to Randy, because I'm one of those guys that, well, I was huge into Randy Rhoads when I was a kid, you know. He was great.
Of course.
Revolutionary. Yeah, yeah. I liked him a lot better than Eddie. He's a little more classical.
You know, both had their thing, and they were both, you know, trendsetters, and, you know, both had compositional skills. You know, if you listen to Mr. Crowley, Crazy Train, the riffs are Randy Rhoads, obviously.
Right.
What you have to do is listen to the 5,000 speed metal bands or, you know, death metal bands that came after. Where did they get those riffs from? And he wrote, they either sped them up or slowed them down.
Right.
There's a guy who had to take Tony Iommi's place. Not exactly small shoes to fill. And yet, you know, the guy, you know, to a certain extent, mopped the floor with Tony Iommi as a player. You know, I say that with reverence. Tony Iommi is a great guitar player, and Black Sabbath was, you know, one of my favorite bands of the day. But one would agree Randy Rhoads certainly filled his footsteps.
Oh, yeah. Took it next level. Since this is a Kiss podcast, we got to get a little bit into your brother Bruce. And are you pretty influential to him as a player? Because I think you guys kind of got a similar style.
Well, we're both influenced by the same people.
Right.
So, yeah, we played together with Meatloaf at a point in time where we were like Hunter Wagner playing with Alice Cooper or Lou Reed. You know, we kind of really focused in on that twin guitar player thing, harmonies and unisons and pop solos and all that stuff. So then we kind of branched off into our own thing. You know, he doesn't sound like me, I don't sound like him, but there were certainly similarities for sure.
Yeah, style wise I could tell you guys apart, you know, just by your tone though, for sure.
Yeah, you know, and Paul's joke from the you know, the 89 tour. So on guitar, one of the Kulick brothers. How do you tell the difference between Bob and Bruce Kulick? Bob's the one with the mustache. I mean, it was a big joke of the tour, and I thought it was effectively fun.
Yeah,
you know,
good.
And that, okay, you know, and both of us obviously play our asses off, but we wouldn't be playing either in Kiss or with Paul. So, you know, his acknowledgement of by making a joke out of it, I thought, showed his comfort with the fact that I actually played with both guys, and they're both great players, and I'm really lucky.
Yeah, you guys are both top-notch, man. Bruce was kind of my guitar player from Kiss when I was a kid, because I grew up in the 80s, you know?
Sure,
so Bruce was my guy, and, you know, in a lot of ways still is. And his compositional skills are ridiculous, you know what I mean? I love it. I just love it. So, you know, it was you that, you know, got Bruce into Kiss, more or less. It was your suggestion. Had they come to you to kind of take over, and then you kind of turned them on to Bruce, or what?
Well, you know, playing on the Kiss Killer stuff and realizing that they were really going to replace Ace. You know, they introduced me to, you know, Vinnie Crisano,
right,
who was in Vinnie Vincent. And I remember both Paul and Gene saying, we know the guy can play and we know the guy can write, but I'm not sure if this is a good mix as far as people goes. And they were right.
Yes.
He just didn't have the wherewithal to be quiet.
Right.
And just allowed somebody to steer the ship. Too many cooks spoil the broth. Whereas when my brother was given the opportunity, he shut up and was able to play the role, you know, and be the good soldier rather than try to take over like Vinny did.
Right. Too many chiefs in the Vinny Vincent days. I just think it's cool that you guys both have played in this band. And I know you've done a lot of other stuff, and you probably get tired of us Kiss freaks only wanting to hear about the Kiss stuff, but it's just really interesting to us, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you had a favorite song that you worked on with Kiss, what would it be?
Probably Larger Than Life solo is probably the best of my soloing, but the song that I like the best that I played on would probably be Nowhere to Run, which we worked up for the 89 tour, but never did.
Yeah, I was going to say, I always kind of hoped that on that tour that he would break out something from Killers, but nope.
Yeah, we rehearsed it, but he just chose not to do it. Not an easy song to sing.
Right. Yeah, I could hear that.
But we weren't tuning down at the time. Trick wasn't employed yet. Had we been tuned down to E-flat or D, probably would have done it. But
right.
You know, standard tuning, hadn't gotten that far yet, even though other bands had done that. You know, it was hard enough for him to have to sing all the songs as opposed to with Kiss, where you had a break with Gene singing some, Ace sang, and Peter sang. This was, he had to sing all the songs.
Right.
Got a lot of work.
Yeah, a lot of work. Plus, he's, you know, the kind of front man he is. It's a workout, you know? So on top of it, he's got to sing all night.
He always gave 100%, I have to say, you know, even the 19th, he's playing a little scratchy or didn't feel great. Still went out there and he's a total star, and, you know, I totally was like in awe of the fact that, wow, this guy really is as good a front man, lead singer as anybody I've ever worked with. And I've worked with some really great singers.
I have to say amen to that, brother.
Yeah, thanks.
I got a couple of questions that came from the listeners, if you wouldn't mind answering them.
Not from the guy who wrote those nasty comments about me on Facebook.
I saw that. I tried to defend you.
I'm just kidding. You know, again, everyone's entitled to their opinion, you know, but if somebody doesn't know somebody, to make comments, it's kind of...
That was kind of a dick move, honestly.
I thought the nice say, why don't you just shut up?
Yeah.
You know?
If you can't be positive, fuck off.
I've seen reviews of my production. Whoever produced it should be shot. And then, you know, honey, pass the gun over. And then the next comment, you know, best version of New York, New York I ever heard in my life when I did that Sinatra CD.
Right.
You know, metal versions of Sinatra songs. So, you know, it's music. It's a matter of personal opinion and taste. So, but, you know, anyway, I was kind of surprised to see somebody take my brother and I on. I never liked either of them. Oh, okay, you don't know, but that's fine, whatever.
Some people just like to hear themselves bitch, you know?
Yeah, I know, it's fine. I just wanted to make the joke, you know?
The two questions are, someone wanted to know, say you did get the gig in Kiss, what would you have made your makeup? What would your makeup have been?
Oh, well, we always had the old joke at the Kiss office. I was always like, all right, so if I'm going to join the band, I'm not going to wear a wig since I've already shaved my head. So it would have to be Ming the Merciless from Flash Gordon.
Right on. I think that maybe Anton LaVey might have beat you to that look, though. You know what I'm saying? Another listener had written in, and it's actually Joe Polo, a friend of mine, who does Podcast Rock City. Yeah! He wanted to know, do you think that Kiss would have been the juggernaut they became if you were in the band?
I have no idea. How could I possibly know?
Right. I think they would have been, you know. You're not that far off from what they were doing.
I'm not. Would have made any difference, you know. I mean, the lead guitar player slot in that band, as important as it was not as important as the gimmick, or, in my own estimation, Paul and Gene's writing of some great songs that really worked, Detroit Rock City and God of Thunder and, you know, whatever it was that, you know, I Want to Rock and Roll All Night, you know, that was their... 4K is they came up with some Love It Loud. They came up with some songs that really worked for them.
Right, great songs. Yeah, and I think that, you know, say the lead guitar solo was a little different, it would still be just as kick-ass.
It's about those songs, you know, to be able to get up and play those songs, simple, straight ahead, but very effective.
Yes, sir. I'm in complete agreement with that, and I think that it would have been interesting, you know, to have had you in Kiss all these years, because I think you probably would have stuck it out. You just seem like that kind of guy to me.
Yeah, you know, I was a band-oriented guy, but, you know, look, you know, it was not my fate, and so, you know, you just accept your fate, and but to be involved with them still in the way that I am, you know.
It's really cool. It's like you got all the perks without having all the hassles of being in that band, you know? It's cool.
To a certain extent, yeah, I guess you could say that, yeah.
It's pretty cool. One last question from the Kiss Freaks. Someone wanted to know, what's your favorite Kiss album?
I don't know if I ever look at it as a favorite Kiss album as I do as much as individual songs.
Right.
You know, so Tears Are Falling or Unholy or Detroit Rock City. I don't think I have an actual favorite. I would make my own compilation. I Want You, you know.
Right.
The song that I really like. You know, Love Gun, you know, it's not specific to one record for me.
I hear you.
I don't look at things that way.
Do you have a favorite one that Bruce had done with the band?
Probably Revenge.
Right, right. I like Revenge. I think it's a little overrated in the catalog, but
considering that he had to deal with what he had to deal with Bob Ezrin and all of what was entailed, I thought he did a really great job.
My favorite Bruce record is Asylum, believe it or not. I just think he's wailing on it, man, coming out of the gate strong. His first record with Kiss. Kill and everything. Great composition too. I mean, if you look at like Tears Are Falling, that solo arrangement, it's beautiful.
Yeah, Tears Are Falling definitely was a shining moment for sure.
Oh yeah, it's great. Yeah, I just love everything you guys have done. You know, I'm starting to sound a bit like a fanboy, but I totally am, and I have to just admit to that. You know,
okay, that's allowed. It's fine.
Yeah. But I know you don't have a whole lot of time, but I want to thank you so much for calling in, Bob.
We'll do another one then at another point, you know?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Let's see if people like this one first.
Yeah, people are going to love it, man. You know, a lot of people love hearing from you, and you have a lot of fans in the Kiss Army, bro. Oh,
yeah! Well, and, you know, I'm going to be a little bit more visible now that I'm living in Las Vegas, and I got a couple of ideas for some other things I'm going to be working on. So, you know, hopefully people will be able to pick up on, you know, what I'm going to be doing, including but not limited to writing my book about all my experiences.
Man, I'd love to read your book.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting for sure.
Definitely. You've got a whole lot of stories that don't even have anything to do with KISS, I'm sure.
Well, you know, it's definitely going to be, you know, the KISS chapter, you know, obviously, you know, Wasp and Meatloaf and Alice Cooper and all the other people that I work with, you know, I'm going to have a chapter for each of those. And,
right.
You know, that people get a sense of some of the talent that I was lucky enough to work with, Lou Reed and John Cale and Diana Ross and, you know, just LaBelle, some of the other people that I was fortunate enough to play with. And, you know,
it's great.
Feel really blessed that, you know, I was in the right place at the right time to be able to attach, you know, preparation to opportunity.
Yeah, that's a lot about what it's about, man. You got to be able to deliver when the opportunity arises, you know?
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. You know, the ability to rise to the occasion, like, okay, here you go. You know, I was like the challenge of it, and, you know, it took it very seriously, obviously, you know, it was what I wanted, you know, to be able to be a lead player, as I said, of the ilk of the guys that I referenced. So to get anywhere close to that was a big victory for me. And, you know, the fact that I still dish it out, you know, just says a lot about my commitment.
Yeah, it's great. I love when someone follows their dreams and succeeds, man. It's just inspirational.
Oh. Yes.
It's great.
So, yeah, let me know how this works out, and we'll do it again.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. All right, I'm glad we finally were able to do this.
Yeah, me too.
So keep in touch.
Yeah.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you so much, Bob.
Sure, absolutely. Have a great one.
You
Take
too.
Care. Thanks.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Cosmic. Don't let anybody say that there isn't fate involved in your lives, people, because this kind of stuff can happen to you also. Life is full of all kinds of changes and amazing coincidences that lead to prosperous fates. How's that?
All right. So there you have it. That my little interview with Bob Kulik. Thanks so much for doing that, Bob. It was really cool of you. And I really do appreciate it, man. And I hope all the fans out there dug it. It was cool. Normally we would do something like that on Skype, but we had to do it on the phone, so the audio is a little wonky in spots, but it is what it is. So I hope you liked it out there, peoples. And as far as strange ways, we want to say thanks so much to all the people who listened to the last couple episodes. We've been getting a lot of downloads. We did the one with Ken Mills. People seem to really dig that, and we want to thank Chris Sinzak, too, for the Dynasty episode. I actually listened to that one recently, because you know me, I do all the editing shit, so by the time it's out, I've already heard it 10 times, and I wait a couple of weeks before I listen to them, so they're fresh, you know. And I was actually I actually enjoyed Chris on there a lot. He was a great guest, as well as the Pawfather.
Oh, that was so cool, geneing with him.
Geneing with him. Hell yeah. Did you see that thing that on Jericho's webs?
Yeah, with him, he's not the Podfather.
Yes, Adam Carolla is not the Podfather, bro.
Yeah. I'm starting to think that Chris Jericho listens to these podcasts.
Well, he is a big KISS freak, so I mean, he's used the Pod of Thunder thing. He's using the fucking Podfather. What's next? In a way, though, some of those things are kind of obvious with a podcast.
Yeah, I guess that's
true. Tie it in, but I don't know. I think you might be right, though. I think dude might be listening.
Ask Jericho.
Yeah.
That'd be cool if he actually does, though. Yeah, celebrity listening to this.
You listening, Jericho? What's up, bro? I really enjoyed your KISS interviews.
Hi, Chris. Please don't hurt me.
Right. I'd be surprised if he was listening, but you never fucking know. I mean, you just don't know who's listening.
Mm-hmm.
But we do appreciate all the people who do listen. Stay tuned. We got a lot of other cool shit coming your way. Pretty soon it's going to be Ace Frehley's birthday, so you know we're going to have a special about that. Coming straight to you from Jindal. We got to.
You're going to eat it like a piece of cake?
Yeah.
Birthday cake?
So, anyways, we're going to have a really cool Ace Frehley episode coming out because we're, you know, we're all about that Ace,
No Vinny.
Right. I actually don't mind Vinny Vincent.
No, but I really like, well, because he made Lick It Up awesome and he made Revenge awesome.
Revenge is debatable in my eye, but we've had that discussion almost every episode.
Oh, yeah, I won't open up that can of worms.
We will get to our Revenge episode someday, people. And I don't think you're going to like what I have to say.
Ooh.
Anyways, we're going to wrap this one up. I hope you liked the Bob Kulik interview. Had a blast doing it. It was cool to talk to that dude. And Just stay tuned, and we'll see you next time. Once again, I'm Jody Havnot.
This is Clinton.
And I'm D-Rock, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, and bye.
Podcast Rock City.
What's up, everybody? This is Joe from Podcast Rock City, where every week, me and my crew will bring you the KISS news of the week. Look at us as kind of a KISS version of Meet the Press, your source for KISS news every week. We're on iTunes, Podomatic, Twitter, and Facebook.
You wanted the best, you got the best. And if you want the hottest show on Monco Radio, join us in the KISS Room. The KISS Room is a monthly radio broadcast celebrating the hottest band in the world.
KISS!
It's your place for all things KISS and some... For broadcast dates and all information, go to thekissroom.com. The KISS Room broadcasts live and worldwide on Monco Radio, where music and minds meet.
All right, KISS Army. Since 2007, you've been getting Podkissed, the KISS audio fanzine for your ears.
That's right, it's your Podkissed. Every month, the Podkissed crew, along with the KISS Room, brings you KISS talk like no one else, whether it be roundtables, interviews with the band past and present, analysis, and great KISS fun.
Hi, this is Ace Frehley, and you're listening to Podkissed.
Hi, this is Bruce Kulick, and you're listening to Podkissed.
The Podkissed, the KISS audio fanzine for your ears.
Kistery Science Theater, the most civilized...
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck me. Come on.
Respectful.
Just imagine Gene it's with like a with like a washtub bass. Boom, 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 boom.
And serious.
No, wait.
Excuse me, Bob. You're going to come over and do my album.
KISS Podcast on the web. Kistery Science Theater. We bust balls because we can.
Hey, everybody, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Chris.
And we're from the Decibel Geek Podcast. And if you love this...
then you'll love us.
That's right. Brand new episode every single Monday. You can find us on iTunes and at decibelgeek.com. And the best thing is, it's rock and roll, and it's always free.
Hey everybody, I'm Cassius, host of the Cassius Morris Show, and I just wanted to tell you guys a little bit about the podcast. My show is kind of like the melting pot where all things collide. I've got musical content, including album roundtables and playlists of all different genres, solo shows about my personal life, and interviews with anybody you can imagine. I've had
Marty Friedman,
plus
Danko Jones,
and even
Brian Redban of Death Squad Studios and the Joe Rogan Experience.
So if you want to check out the show, head over to thatreporterkid.com or look up Cassius Morris on iTunes.
I'm afraid I've given you all the time I can spare at the moment, my dear. You'll have to come back. Thank you, and goodbye.